I'm not kind of studying the physics of energy or spirituality. I'm not studying traditional medicines and herbs that people take. What I'm trying to do is to unpack how they work. So if you look at the data that shows people who are engaged in these practices regularly live longer, healthier, happier lives, I want to know why.
Welcome back to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, the Executive Director, and today, in a world teeming with questions and uncertainty, we're going to zone in on the subject of spirituality. David DeSteno, a psychologist at Northeastern University, studies the mind's foundation for moral behavior, and he's been looking at the science behind the benefits of religion. His research suggests that people who engage in spiritual practices and rituals, regardless of faith, tend to live longer and happier lives. Well, for some people, this provides sufficient proof that God works. Whereas others, more skeptical people, might well ask, well, what's the science behind this? And can one not enjoy the benefits by just going through the motions of ritual without buying into the whole belief system? For millennia, people have turned to shamans, rabbis, priests, and imams to help them deal with the big challenges of life: grief, loss, birth, death, morality, and meaning. In his book, DeSteno shows how numerous religious practices and rituals have helped people through these issues and also improved their emotional and physical health. In the book, he says, when it comes to thinking about how to help people through life's travails, we scientists shouldn't be starting from scratch. When it comes to managing the human experience, it would be strange if thousands of years of religion didn't have much to offer. In the repetition of prayer, stillness in contemplation, joining of hands in celebration or sorrow, dancing and singing. To ignore that body of knowledge is to slow the progress of science itself and limits its potential benefit to humanity. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
Well, you've struck upon something quite important here, which is that there is a huge drop off in, particularly in millennials, saying they're affiliated to any kind of religion. And I wondered if you thought there was several reasons for that, whether this was partly a behavioral thing of millennials or if it was in conjunction with scandals in churches that have dropped off membership in the older age groups, or if you had any kind of theory about it.
It's dropping off among all age groups, but more so among the young. And this is the first year since Gallup first started asking this question in the 1930s. That a majority of people have reported not being a member of a church, a temple, or a mosque. But the interesting thing is when these people are leaving, and you know, we call them nones, N-O-N-E-S, meaning they don't identify with any specific religious tradition. Most of them aren't becoming atheists. They're looking for new ways to be spiritual. Right. And I think it's because they know they feel a need for these tools. So why are they leaving? You know, a lot of it is institutional failures having to do with, you know, whether it's child abuse or sexual scandals or financial scandals. Sometimes it's just, you know, your belief system, you just can't abide by what the institution believes in terms of even gender discrimination. Women can't be priests in the Catholic Church and in other religions. But I think people are looking for new ways. And there's kind of three ways that are happening, three routes. One route is people are kind of, and this is, I think, the smallest route, but it is definitely represented. Some people are doing what I call the return. And by that, I mean, they're actually becoming more orthodox. That is, they're looking back to the more ancient forms of the ritual. So I'll mention it in the Catholic Church just because it's one primary thing now. You know, there's a big brouhaha about, are we going to do the ritual, the Mass of Vatican II, or go back and do the Latin Mass, etc. In Judaism, a lot of younger people are becoming more orthodox than their families were. And for some, it's because those rituals tend to be more involving in some sense, in all of the senses, right? There's the symbolism, there's the chanting, the music, the olfactory elements of incense for some. There are these things that nudge us and affect us on a much deeper level. And for those people, it's speaking to them, whereas the modern day version of worship without that music, without that symbols, feels kind of empty to them. Another group are those who are trying to do the ritual elements without having any larger theological element attached to it. So it's funny, you know, you and I talked about Greg Epstein is a humanist rabbi, and he was just elected to be the chief rabbi, the chief chaplain at Harvard. For those of people who don't know, humanistic Judaism is a small branch of Judaism where everyone is atheist, but yet they recognize the value of rituals like Shiva and Bar and Bat Mitzvahs and Passover and all of these things as markers for certain stages of life that help us through these stages, give us a cultural identity, bring us together in solidifying the groups. And so it's a way of using these tools while still saying we don't believe in a divine power. For some, it's like that. Unitarian Universalism is kind of that, but even more open. You can believe in a divine power. You don't have to. And they kind of mix and match different elements together to try and find a new way. And the third way I think people are going is basically creating something entirely new. That may sound kind of strange, but every religion we have today started that way. Someone thought they had a better way. And the ones that go on and grow are the ones that actually speak to people and help them meet these challenges of life. And so there are ones that are trying to incorporate, you know, spirituality with neuroscience. There are ones based on, there was a church that just folded that was based on the religion of AI, where the AI was going to become all-knowing by putting together, you know, vast amounts of knowledge on the net and figuring out what is the appropriate way to live. I'm not in favor of that, but people are trying all of these things. But I think the argument that I would make is when we do this, if you want to succeed, what you need to do is to honor these past rituals and to use them. In some senses, they're kind of debugged technologies, right? We know meditation does certain things. We know singing and chanting certain ways affects our brains and our bodies. We know all these different elements. They can be used for new purposes, but it's hard to create something new on the fly. And that's why the argument is look to the old, but find out using science, if you want, how to adapt them in new ways.
You're listening to Cambridge Forum as we consider how God works, the science behind the benefits of religion, with psychologist David DeSteno from Northeastern University. I'm just going to shoot over. Somebody has typed a question in. Mm-hmm. Has anyone studied the effects of doing call and response or responsively reading aloud? I've seen this practice in services in several different religions.
I haven't seen call and response. I've seen work on singing together and praying together in unison. And my assumption is it would be similar for call and response. Again, anytime we put people into synchronous motion, and that can be either moving together at the same time or call and response back and forth, what this does is it makes people feel closer. It makes them feel more connected. And not only will that make you feel more compassionate and more connected to each other, but if you're giving messages at the same time in prayer, you get kind of like a conformity effect in the sense that we're all believing this. And the closer I feel to you, the more I want to believe what you believe, assuming I like you and we're doing this together. And so it can then reinforce the elements, right? And so if you look at this, people will often say, well, how is this any different than a club? Right? Clubs give people social contact. Isn't that just what religion is doing if you're going to services? If you look at the newest data, what it shows is the benefits in terms of well-being and physical and mental health are beyond those of just social contact in clubs. And I think why is because these other elements work to kind of create a greater sense of community. I mean, even in our lab, right, we have people do this to music, do this kind of moving in synchrony. They don't know each other from Adam, yet from going from 16 to 50%, they're likely to go say, hey, that guy needs help. I want to help them take time out of my day. I feel for him. Basically, what you're doing there is creating a bond out of thin air. you add that together and lots of other elements, and what that's going to do is create a much greater influence on our feelings of connection and cohesion than just showing up once a month at, you know, your college's alumni group or reading group or whatever it might be.
I think you kind of hit upon an interesting point here, particularly mentioning Greg Epstein. Apparently his big thing is building different types of groups and different faiths and denominations. Mm-hmm. So they've all got a conversation. But I think it's proof. He says that he's got a lot of people that don't belong to a religion or have become disenchanted with the religion they were raised in. These are young students, mm-hmm. but they still want to be good human beings and they want to lead an ethical life. So I think that there's this need that right now doesn't seem to be being met by mainstream religion, yeah. organized religion. And we're going to talk about this a little bit more. You have a section in the book, Mystics, Monastics and Mushrooms. I wondered if you'd talk about that a little bit, about another way of trying to reach that peak experience or transcendental.
Yeah, sure. Let me say something about the being a good person first, and then I'll be happy to go into that. So you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the biggest challenges of morality, of being a good person, is being willing to sacrifice in the moment, delaying your own immediate gratification to help others, right? That is, if you cheat, I can cheat now and I can get money, but then over time I'm hurting others and I'm hurting myself in the long run because no one will want to be with me, et cetera. But, you know, humans, we're focused on our own immediate gratification. We're kind of built that way, but we also have to be able to be good, to be honest, to be fair, to be generous, to be patient, to be kind, because we live in a larger group. And the data actually show that people who are generous, kind, trusting, on the whole, on average, have better outcomes. Being a nice person does pay in the end. And the question is, how do we deal with that? And so again, can you be a good person without being religious or spiritual? Sure, of course you can. You can embrace ethical principles and do it. But what these rituals and practices give you are tools. So let me again give you an example. One thing we study a lot in my lab is the emotion experience of gratitude. And when we make people feel grateful, they become more honest, right? We've seen, you know, we'll say, flip this coin in private, tell us what it came up. If it came up heads, you get a lot more money than if it came up tails. Of course, we can see what it came up on hidden camera. And people, you know, 30, 40% of people will lie to get the more money. When we make them feel grateful, it drops to like 2 or 5%. When people feel grateful in the moment, they're more willing to help others. They're more willing to share money equitably. They're more generous. And what we're doing is by changing your emotional state. Emotions exist to change what we do. And when you're feeling grateful in the same way you would pay somebody back because they did a favor, you also pay things forward. And so we tell people all the time, well, you can do gratitude journals. That will make you feel more grateful and be more ethical and be more patient. But if you look at religion, it's all over the place, right? Christians often every day say grace before they eat. It's a way of cultivating gratitude. Jews, every morning, there's the prayer, the Modiani, which is the first thing you do when you wake up is you give thanks to God that your soul has been returned to you and that you're here on this earth. And then during the day, you're grateful for 100 different things, your clothes, your food. Now, some of that is kind of old and sexist because in the original prayers, you could say, I'm thankful that I'm a man and not a woman. So we can change the words, right, to be what they are now. And a lot of reform congregations do that. But it's a way of cultivating gratitude every day. And in Islam, gratitude is important in lots of religions. And by cultivating these experiences every day, by ritualizing them, what you're doing is giving yourself a booster shot to make yourself more ethical. If you come in my lab and I say, count your blessings, and then I give you an opportunity to cheat, I have ample data time and again that you'll cheat less and you'll be more generous and be more patient. These make it ways that you do it every day so you don't forget. Your question on psychedelics, I think, is a good one. In the book, the chapter, as you say, is called Mystics, Monastics, and Mysticism.
Mushrooms,
thank you. Transcendence, right, is, and I have not had one of these experiences myself, but from everything I've heard, it is an amazing, amazing state where you feel kind of connection to some people to a higher power, some people to everyone, some people to the universe at large, but is an incredibly moving experience. And there are two ways people typically get there. They're often called the right-handed route and the left-handed route. The right-handed route is the way that's kind of embedded within traditional religions. And so things like meditation. Over time, through different types of meditative activities, you can reach these stages of transcendence. Whether we're talking Hindu, Buddhist, or even Christian meditation, there's wonderful Christian mystics who talk about these experiences where they kind of melt into the Godhead and it becomes this experience of oneness. Or you can do it the quick way, which is to the left-handed route, which is to basically take substances. So you can, you know, psychedelics, you can drink ayahuasca, you can eat magic mushrooms, which have psilocybin in them, and have a similar experience. The interesting thing is if you look at the neuroscience behind this, long-standing meditation, the way you enter that experience of what's called ego death, where your self kind of fades away and you have this experience of connection, it causes reductions in a certain network in the brain. It's the same one that psychedelics target. And so the same thing is happening to your brain. It's one is through practice, one is through pharmacologic intervention. But the trick is, when you're doing these pharmacological interventions, is to have a guide. So oftentimes, and I've seen Michael Pollan talk about this, and I've looked at the research as well, you know, 15 or 20% of the times, people can have really bad, scary trips. When you feel ego death, when you feel yourself dissolve, that can be beautiful, moving, or it can be terrifying. And about 2% of people after these experiences actually seek psychiatric care because it was so kind of shattering to them. Now, if you do these with the shamans, right, at the time you're doing them, they are your guides. There's often, they'll be singing and chanting these in ayahuasca ceremonies, they're called Icaros. And these chants, what they do is, as you chant, they create a rhythm. They slow your breathing rate. And as we slow your breathing rate, that affects your vagal nerve, which affects your heart rate, which slows it down. So when you slow your breathing down by taking deeper, slower breaths through chanting, it slows your heart rate down. That sends signals up to your brain, which basically says, okay, everything around you is safe. So normally when we feel safe, our heart rate slows. But if you artificially slow your heart rate with these techniques, it tells your brain everything is safe and calm and protected. And so when that moment of ego death comes, these rituals provide a scaffold to make sure you feel calm and you feel okay. And it makes it much more likely a positive trip. Johns Hopkins has this wonderful center led by Roland Griffiths, which studies psilocybin. And they've done work where they give people these under controlled conditions. And it's usually somebody on the team sits with them, talks with them, and stays with them. So if they're starting to have a bad trip, they'll hold their hand, they'll put it on their chest. It's someone being there to, again, scaffold you to make sure, like a shaman would do. 75% of these people report that the experience was one of the most profound experiences and meaningful experiences of their lives. A lot of people who have terminal diseases and do this suddenly report being okay with it and telling other people not to worry. And so these are tremendous tools. And we're seeing now, you know, that the VA is now studying these as ways to deal with PTSD. The trick, though, is it's not just the medicine. It's the social scaffolding that these rituals provide around it that work together as a technology to make these things happen.
By the way, if people are interested in that, I would suggest they watch Fantastic Fungi, which is on Netflix. It's a documentary all about the amazing properties of mushrooms. And it actually goes to Johns Hopkins as part of the investigation. And this man said he came out and he's now unafraid of dying. And he's a young man. He just feels completely confident about dying. So it definitely changed his life. So it's certainly worth looking at. Okay. The pandemic has, well, I wouldn't say it's come and gone, but it's the worst of it last year. Lockdown is, for most of us here, not as bad, certainly in sections of the country. We've got a semblance of normalcy. What data came out about prayer during the pandemic? Did anything emerge that
yeah
kind of what one.
Yeah. So this is data from Pew. During the worst parts of the pandemic last year, about 55%, and this is data on Americans, about 55% of people were praying frequently for better health, for the safety of their family, for the pandemic to end. But the interesting thing about that is 15% were people who report seldom or never praying before. And 24% of those are people who don't belong to any religion in particular. And so what you're seeing here again is in the face of a major challenge to life that kind of uprooted a lot of our things, people turn to religion. And again, you know, we've heard this, oh, religion is just the opiate of the masses. Wouldn't it be better if they were actually doing stuff? And in fact, there was a bit of a brouhaha over vaccination, because I remember Steve Pinker putting out on Twitter that, you know, belief in the afterlife is a malignant delusion because it prevents people, he's talking about evangelicals in particular, from getting vaccines because he said they don't value life here and they'll just go on to life ever after. I don't think that's true. I think that was because of political ideology. I don't think it had anything to do with valuing life. And in fact, if you look at the data, people who are religious drink less, abuse substances less, get more nutrition, live longer, have better health. So it's not like belief in an afterlife is like nothing matters in this world, let's, because it's going to be better in the next. So I think, you know, that view is wrong. But what you're finding again is people turning to this. And I think the reason they're turning to it is because it offers tools. Belief offers tools to reduce uncertainty. Now you might say, well, Dave, isn't that silly? Not really, because when you're trying to make every decision, and we think about this, you know, I've had this experience myself. It's like, should I go here? What's the risk here? Should I go there? What kind of mask should I wear? This is a KN95. Is that the same as an N95? What's the rate of unvaccinated people here? What's the R factor there? When you're trying to weigh everything, it can be incredibly taxing. And you want to make good and informed decisions. But at the same time, people who also, after making good informed decisions, have a sense of, okay, I'm just in some sense either going to leave it to a higher power, or if you're a Buddhist, you're going to say, I've done what I can do. The other things are out of my control. Therefore, I'm not going to worry about them. So there are different ways to not worry, whether it's a spiritual philosophy or belief in a higher power. But all of those things take the onus off of us to try and maximize every single decision to make sure we're doing something that we're not going to regret. And that causes immense amounts of stress itself. So it's not that you should be blind and not think about and not make decisions, just say, oh, everything will be fine. No, but it's a way of helping us be satisfied with the decisions we're making and to not obsess about things in a way that creates greater anxiety. But the hard part about COVID in general too is suddenly the ways we normally seek comfort from people, we couldn't, right? We were isolating with each other. And that raised questions of how do we connect? You know, even if you lost people to COVID or just during COVID, you know, you were having funerals over Zoom. And think about what I just said about Shiva. Normally in Shiva, people sit together and they have that synchrony from praying and swaying together, and they cover their mirrors so they don't see each other. Well, when you're on Zoom, your face is right in front of you, right? And so the question is, when we have to adapt the ways that these rituals have been done because of changes to the system that we can't control, this is where science can actually help religion. I have a friend who's a rabbi, and he says to me, I want to know what science says about which of these practices and how I can adapt them will make them work better, because we were just flying by the seat of our pants, and they had to, right? We all had to during COVID. But I think it's an opportunity for science and religion to work together.
We've got another question, Dave, just came in. Are you familiar with Lynn McTaggart's book, The Field?
And no, I'm sorry, I'm not.
Okay, so that's going to be, the question was, what does your research shed on the human experience of a common energy field? Well,
oh, That I don't know. I'm not kind of studying the physics of energy or spirituality. I'm not studying, you know, the biologics. I mean, there's whole things in terms of traditional medicines and herbs that people take. I'm not looking at that. I'm not trying to answer theological questions. What I'm trying to do is to look at these practices to unpack how they work. So if you look at the data that shows people who are engaged in these practices regularly live longer, healthier, happier lives, I want to know why. And so my goal and what I do in this book is I look at different stages across the lifespan, from birth, new parents bonding to their babies, to how we build character, to how we become adolescents to adults, marriage and connection, health, healing, death and loss. At each stage, how do rituals around the world work to help us do that? And how can we take some of that knowledge in a respectful way and use it? But I'm not trying to answer any theological questions about, does God exist or is there an energy field?
I tell you what I've always wanted to look at, and I still think this is a worthwhile experiment. In this absence of organized or comparative religion being taught in high school, in my high school, we were taught all sorts mm-hmm. of comparative religions just to examine. And people came in from all different backgrounds and talked about what they believed in, which is very interesting. But in the absence of that here, I think it would be fascinating to actually teach ethics, because it isn't being taught in schools. And I think that relying on sort of some ad hoc bit of good luck mm-hmm. that a person is going to suddenly adopt good practices or how to be a good citizen, basically.
You're absolutely right. I teach this course I'm a professor at Northeastern University. I teach this course called The Moral Mind. My job isn't to tell you what your ethics should be, but I see it as my job, psychologically speaking, to take each of these ethical issues and show you how your mind works and what levers push it one way or the other. So that way, once you choose what is your ethics, or what are your ethics, you know how your mind works. Because, you know, we have this work, you know, we study people all the time, and I'll ask them, even anonymously, would you cheat on in this type of situation? And 100 people will say no. 100% of people will say no. It's one of the few rare times you get unanimity in a response. Then I put them in the experiment. I give them anonymity, and 75% of them cheat. Right. And so, and I don't think it's because they're lying. I think it's because they don't think they would cheat, but when push comes to shove, they often convince themselves of why it was okay this time. Mm-hmm. And so my job is scientifically to explain what those pressures are and how your mind goes about making these decisions and even fooling yourself, so that you can prepare yourself and be ready. And I see religion as providing tools. And what I'm talking about really are, these tools are kind of like vaccines. If you do them regularly, you will be more ethical. You will be more kind. You might have more connection and even more transcendent experiences and less grief, right? They help you through life. And so, you know, I completely agree that ethics should be taught in one way or another, even better, from multiple perspectives.
So I want to thank you so much for talking about all this research that went into your book, The Science Behind the Benefits of Religion, with psychologist David DeSteno. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Cambridge Forum is made possible by the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, Mass Cultural Council, City of Cambridge, and you. So step up and donate via the website cambridgeforum.org, where you will find a podcast of this program shortly and details of upcoming programs. Thanks for listening.